Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Larkin Kemp. And for the first time in 2026, Nick, there is so much to update you with.
Hi. Hi, Terry. Hi, Larkin. I apologize, but nobody in America works harder than me. So, you know, and the only other thing that I will say is I've probably gotten 150 texts, 200 emails going, dude, I'm not going to listen to the tailgate if it's just Terry and Larkin. I was tuning in for you. So to all my fans, welcome back.
There we go. We got a ton to talk about. A stacked weekend, a week two of college lacrosse. And both boys are going to get a chance to talk about their alma maters. But we are going to throw it all the way back to Friday to get things started because we had a number one versus number two matchup in the JMA Wireless Dome. Nikki, what happened?
Well, a lot of people were making some big accusations about Syracuse. We have always been on the train that they are progressing, and this is potentially the year, and they are starting off their season with a staple win over number one Maryland. Honestly, a really good game. Spallina is him. Maryland is not. And this is the one of those games that in the early slates – you're kind of curious about how it's going to go. Is Michael Leo? Is it going to be Joey Spallina? How is the Syracuse going to respond to a, you know, a historically good, you know, traditionally good Maryland defense? To me, Terry, it came down to the faceoff X. When Syracuse has the ability to play make it take it as they did for most of the first half, it's such a hard hill to climb out of, especially for game one, when there's not a whole lot of film, when you're not really expecting. It seemed to me like Syracuse had the advantages of Maryland knowing who's good, but not how they're going to be utilized. That to me was the big separating factor, the X and the faceoffs and the variety with which Syracuse can score on you was ultimately too tough for Maryland to handle. I do think it's worth noting that this Maryland team graduated a lot of talent, is younger, and I think that this game by no means, as head coach John Tillman was saying after the game, I do think it's one of those things that it's not an overreaction panic button for Maryland. They played well. They're going to get better throughout the season. What were your takeaways from this game, Terrence Foy?
So I think you're right. The game was decided in the second quarter when Syracuse was able to build that 7-4 lead heading into halftime. And that was when Johnny Mullen was building the advantage at the faceoff X. You make the comment about the lack of film, and that's true. But when Henry Dodge was at Vermont last year, these guys played each other. So there was at least that measure of familiarity. And I think it was also interesting, you know, how Maryland was able to adjust. And eventually, you know, the faceoff ended up turning roughly into a 50-50 battle. And so there's another side of the coin where you could basically say, like, this came down to late game execution offensively, particularly at the Maryland end, and they just didn't have it. And I think one of the things there that you point to is the contrast relative to their game against Loyola when they put up 19, and it felt like, you know, they had really tied everything together in a way that they hadn't, both in their January scrimmages and in the fall as well. And because the storyline for this team was always going to be, you're bringing back two starting attackmen and Eric Spanos and Braden Irksa, and you're importing two starting attackmen from Yale and Leo Johnson and Chris Lyons, and there's only three spots. How is it going to work from a chemistry standpoint, from a familiarity standpoint, and from an ego standpoint? And that is, to me, a reflection of it being a very long season. Everybody has said if there's a group that's going to be able to figure it out, it's going to be a John Tillman, Mike Phipps offense. But I do think it was telling that post-game, Tills did his three-card Monty trick where, you know, it was they were the underdog, and Syracuse was the number one team in the country despite the fact that they were not by any poll and that they were not the favored team, and they were not the team that had won eight straight in the series dating back to 2009. So, you know, I love it, right? It's a great tone setter. And the thing that's particularly good about it is, you know, while we graduate from this game, we also are going to get to Princeton's surprising season opening loss to Penn State. And that little trifecta that I had identified as being a top three tier of its own, those other two teams, you know, those other two matchups are going to happen here over the course of the next month. So with that, Larkin, what did you take away from Friday night?
First, I just thought it was a great lacrosse game. I mean, if it was a best of seven series, like the old hockey adage, that you're not really in trouble until you lose on home ice. Like, I think if lacrosse was a sport where Syracuse went in the season, later in the season to Bird, I think Maryland could be favored in that game. So, like, I don't think the Cuse faithful should get out in front of their skis, but what it does do is it cements them at the top of the RPI table. And if they just take care of business the rest of the way, they're going to be in a great position come Selection Sunday, just based on the strength of that win alone. I thought the Spallina-Schaller matchup was as advertised. It was great. Maryland's super rules-based in how they play razor picks, and March did a really good job of creating spatial leverage for Spallina to shoot around if he wanted to, feed around, ultimately like force that defense to move. I thought 26, the pole for Maryland, was as advertised. He's a great player. And I thought you nailed it. Like, ultimately, this is a very different story if, like, Chris Lyons and Urksa just play slightly better and Maryland goes and wins 13-12, right? So they had six or seven possessions late in that fourth quarter where the defense kept getting the ball back. It was like a one or two goal game, and they just couldn't generate any momentum. Like, no one was really winning their matchups, the low wing or the high wing. And late in clock, a lot of times it was just like, give the ball to Lyons and let them dodge hard, and ultimately threw two people. And for perspective, that's someone who didn't even dodge when Yale was trying to make tournament runs. Like, Brandow had the rock, and he was like a half, you know, a big ready half wall shooter. So I guess the question is Spanos hurt? That'd be one. And then two, you know, do they just have enough athleticism on the front end? But listen, all in all, it's just a great lacrosse game.
So you hit on the thing that I really want to dive into, and both of you guys are better to speak to this than me, which is just the nature of a number one versus a number one matchup. And Larkin, you were making the point during the game that Joey couldn't run past Will Schaller. And then I watched lacrosse all weekend, and generally speaking, number one attackmen do not run past number one defensemen. They are almost always going to run off of a pick. Sometimes there's going to be a switch. Sometimes there's going to be an advantage gained through the pick. And we saw that, right? Joey shot through Schaller off of, as you described it, a razor pick at X, and he got topside. And then there were other instances in which he either, you know, scored in transition or, you know, found space in other kind of while the defense was moving situations, and he finished with four goals and assist, right? And so I guess my question is, what is the expectation? And Nick, you have not spoken in the longest amount of time, so I'm going to direct this to you first, and then Larkin, yeah, I want to hear what you think. What is the expectation for, like, you're not a number one if you can't win your matchup?
You know, what's funny, and I might be inadvertently speaking ill of my former head coach in college, we hated being number one because that let Coach Corrigan.
Dude, you're us. Just not even paying attention.
What's, yeah, the number one matchup?
No, like the number one attackman, right? Like Joey Spallina, not athletic enough to run past Will Schaller. But he ends up with five points, four goals and an assist. Like, how is that? Like, my thing is, if you're going to be productive and you're going to be guarded by your opponent's best defenseman, then I don't really care if you're, like, scoring unassisted goals off the dodge and, you know, running through a slide in order to do it. But And it's definitely the nature of Joey being the number one recruit in his class and not being
and
Brennan O'Neill.
Playing, like Al Shadow. And the specific jersey he's wearing.
Sure, but
he packs it there.
All right, answer the question now that you understand it better.
Well, first off, I was going to arrive at the point that by the time we had one-on-one matchups, like the guys that I knew that could execute well – their legs were jellies. So leading into that, we knew that the best way to utilize the people that have that gravitational pull, which was a topic that we talked about quite a bit last year, when they were going against a one-on-one, and I'll use Kavanaugh as an example. Obviously, he has a different game than Spallina, but drawing on my own experiences, the gravity that they can pull, knowing that they're not going to beat the number one player, would have usually just as big of an impact. So going in and expecting a one-on-one matchup more often than not, if you're going against a better defender, the entire offense is on the same page, that it's more about preoccupying and having the entire defense go, oh, that's number 50 for Notre Dame, or, you know, that's whoever it is, which allowed all of us to move off ball better. It seemed like Syracuse had a had an ability to figure that out, going, hey, we're not going to get just true separation, but that means we're going to get more creative about picks. We're going to get more creative, especially with a guy who can dish the rock just as well as he can draw with his feet. Like, it changes the mindset from the Dodger of, oh, you know, as an off-ball player, I can sit and watch him do what he does, to I better be hunting the lanes and we better find ways to get him more space by occupying our defenders on the backside and taking advantage of those skip lanes. So it becomes this interesting kind of game theory of how much attention are they going to put on him. Usually it's more than is warranted, which allows everybody else to get a little bit more involved. So it more so depends, and I think it's a bit of a rookie question, to be honest, because the skill set of the number one guy will have a bigger impact than just this broad one-on-one statement. And I think Spleen is a guy who can make not just the, you know, fill up the G's, but fill up the A's. So, you know, that's my takeaway, but glad that you cut me off to chastise me about not listening. That was really nice.
You certainly were out the locks a little bit. That's okay, though. But your answer then made up for it. Just to push back, I don't think there's anything more intimidating for a defense than when an offense can go five high, like Achilles at Troy, and like Pat Spencer just dodges and can smoke whoever he wants to at X. So, like, while there are different types of high-end first-team All-American quality attackmen, there is nothing more intimidating than like the dodge first, shifty and or bull dodging menace who, like, there is no one who can cover it. I would put Jake Hurst in that box of you really have to help to him. Doesn't matter who's on. That's slightly different, in my opinion, than like Lyle, who would kind of like jog into it and lean, and like you would make decisions on when you're going to time your hedge. But he's not like blowing by people. I mean, Nick, you're giving me a face like I'm crazy. Like, you don't think there's any, as a defense, you don't think like Mikey Powell picking up the rock at Geely's scary?
With all five guys standing 30 yards away? Now, hold on. I just did what Terry did, but I didn't cut you off, because I was going to say, are you comparing Spallina to Pat Spencer? And I would say,
so what I'm suggesting is, when an offense is designed currently, Syracuse brings both sub and above GLE picks to the ball for Spallina because they think he's high IQ, has Canadian influence, and they actually want the defenseman to potentially slip under or play sides. Like, that is very different than other high-end attackmen we've seen who literally pick up the rock and tell the rest of their teammates to, like, head to the sub box. Like, they're like, I got this. Like,
yes,
get out.
Agreed.
So
what we're really talking about is the standard of the best player in the country each year, right?
Yeah, and they're like make and model. Like, there's different ways, there's different types of cars that can go fast, right? Like, now, when you wear that number and you want to walk the stage at the Torreton celebration, it is okay, in my opinion, like, for the judgment to be different. Like, Will Schaller in a phone booth against Joey Spallina or Sean Light in a phone booth is a very different conversation than, did Joey Spallina get the job done Friday night? Was he high efficiency, right? Like, was he elite at creating scoring leverage and creating opportunities for his, you know? But that's different than Kobe Bryant at the high elbow saying, boys, there's 10 seconds left. Go stand in the corner. Like, I got this.
So I told you guys ahead of time, this was the conversation that I wanted to go deepest on. And we've touched on a couple of things that I would be interested in going back through. So, like, Steele Stanwyck, not somebody who you would call on to do what you just did, pick up at the end line and send everybody to the midline, right? That was not his game. Rob Pinnell, a little bit more so. Peter Baum, a little bit more so. Jordan Wolfe, definitely more so. Jordan Wolfe is probably, he's the fastest end line to GLE player of the last 20 years, right? So then Dylan Malloy, so Lyle Thompson, Miles Thompson, the next Wharton winners. Dylan Malloy, after that, you already addressed Lyle. Where does Dylan fall into this category?
What defenders would say about Dylan is they respect the consistency at which he puts his head down into traffic. So his lack of athleticism but his willingness to engage in like physicality is, I think, that earns the respect of a Tucker Durkin. Like, he's going every time. Every time he's gone. That's, you know, you got to tip your cap.
Is that, was stamina his, like, secret power?
I mean, he led the team in turnovers. Joyce Blatt is not going to lead the country in turnovers.
Okay.
Like Dylan.
So that's a mentality thing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's Tonka truck. And
just from a defensive perspective, Larkin, I'm curious if you'll agree. I would almost rather, and as it relates to Spallina, I think it's a bit more of a difficult task because, you know, even though Jordan Wolfe toasted every defender that he, you know, went against, it was a pretty consistent look. We know he's going to get to his right hand. If he goes to his left, it's not going to be as lethal of a passing threat to his left. And with what I see from Joey Spallina, it's almost difficult to get consistency in rep after rep. Like the ways in which he can beat you and utilize his teammates to beat you, that's going to draw a slide guy that might not be prepared. So not only do you have to stop Spallina, but you have to efficiently and effectively play a new sort of pick over and over again. You know, by bringing and drawing in more defenders, which Syracuse can do really, really effectively, it's not just isolating that slide and recovery. It's isolating a slide, a recovery, a switch, a get through, a, you know, be organized on the backside. And it's more of a team effort to stop Joey Spallina than it is, hey, you know, Jordan Wolfe is going to toast his guy and we just have to get on his hands before he can get a clean pass off.
And it's also a compliment. He's a coach's kid. Like, it's kind of like the Tom Shriver comment where you could argue Spallina really does try and make the right play. Like, there might be a game, like, say they're playing Notre Dame and 19 or Leo is, like, really feeling it. There may be a game where Spallina takes a back seat and says, listen, like, the right thing for the offense and the leverage is just to play high and away pairs with those two guys, right? And, like, he may blend in and the whole world will be down his throat on that. But it's just to the exact question Terry's asking, there are players who have played in the last decade who would never allow that to happen, right? That could be a negative.
And the game plan would not have been designed for that to be the case.
Right, that could be a negative. And the good news for Syracuse, which is very, very different than some of the other schools we've talked about, but Peter Baum at Colgate, like, he doesn't have Wyatt and Michael Leo playing the other pair. Like, he just doesn't, right? So he's going.
And I thought that it was I thought that it was notable that from my standpoint, Joey's worst play of the game, I can't remember whether it was late in the first quarter or early in the second, but he ISO'd, got lefty on Schaller, and it just felt like he was intentionally forcing it, and he got saved. And like beyond that, he didn't really make a mistake, but that was just, it kind of felt like in that moment, he felt the burden of trying to make a play, and you don't want to get baited into that. You brought up a good point, which is got to keep eyes on Eric Spanos. He was, in my opinion, looked like he was wearing more protection on his left leg. He's always worn the knee brace on his right knee. But
I thought he was facing right, and the way he reacted to get touched from behind by Dwan is probably the biggest red flag.
So left the field. I can't remember. I'm almost positive he did not return to the game. And the Terps have Princeton coming up this Saturday. So they're you know, it's going to be an all hands on deck type situation. So why don't we take that opportunity to get to the second game on the rundown, Nicholas?
Segway City from Terry Foy. Speaking of Princeton, not a great showing from the Princeton Tigers. They played Penn State. Penn State, quite frankly, won the game in the first quarter. After the first quarter was over, it was 7-1 Penn State. Penn State, interesting start to their season. They bounced back after a not good showing and a loss against Villanova. I mentioned they were up 7-1 after the first clip, and it was final score of 13-7. What was interesting to me about this game was Penn State's balanced offense. Four multi-goal scorers, and it quite frankly made an insurmountable lead for Princeton. Kabiri is good, but at the end of the day, a 61% save percentage from Hawkins at Penn State, to me, was kind of the ultimate game decider. When a goalie plays good and you have a 7-1 lead, that is a tough pill to swallow and something that you're not going to be able to come back from. Terry or Larkin, who wants to take it?
Larkin, you have anything to say about this one?
This was stunning to me. I rewatched, 25 minutes of Penn State Villanova to try and reset my, to think back on like what I got wrong. To me, I thought Princeton's offense was just going to be too much to handle for the Penn State defense. If you had told me that not only does Penn State win this game, but that Princeton looks anemic athletically at certain positions on the field, I would have been like blown away by that. I think Princeton is a super loaded group up front this year. Like, you know, you guys have heard my theory around Bonanno stepping in for McAtee. I think Plumbo and the offensive middies are as good as anyone in the country, potentially. It always comes down to the polls with Princeton. They really haven't had, a true cover one since like Chad Wiedermeyer. Is that a crazy take? I know a lot of people like Bullshine, but it's been a long time since they had like a super high end cover. So now I do want to say this. I think the Ivy's really weak this year in terms of top end. And I am in no way suggesting Princeton is out of it by any stretch in terms of the Ivy League tournament or potentially back in the way into the tournament or anything. So we're going to learn a lot more because they have Maryland this week, right? But I was stunned by this. Stunned.
So last week we talked about don't overreact to results in Hulubu Hall or Villanova early season upsets, and the Wildcats lost to St. Joe's and Penn State won a game outside. I did not expect that point to be bolstered so quickly. Nick, I think you hit the nail on the head with the early start component of this. And, this was a team that had played two games, playing a team that had not played yet. I don't think that the entirety of this result is able to be chalked up to that. But I do think that, once that 7-1 kind of early punch was weathered, right, which was basically the entirety of the first half, Princeton was able to play even. And you can make an argument that that was a reflection of Penn State taking their foot off the gas, thinking that they had things under control, and it never really got, it didn't get to one, right? We're going to talk about Albany Cornell. That game got closer. Even Richmond, Virginia got closer. I mean, this never got within three after Princeton cut it to 10-7 with 10 minutes to go. I like to say which area of the field either is most attributable for the loss or needs to have a closer look taken at it, in order to identify, all right, where are the priorities that we need to patch up? And, a 13-7 loss is basically like everything, right? Because you didn't score enough goals to win. There's no scenario under which, and you feel like you can't allow 13 to Penn State and expect to win. And so the thing that I kind of gravitated to rewatching the game were the goals that Princeton were giving up kind of unsustainable? And this was a similar lens through which I looked at the goals that Cornell was giving up to Albany. And it felt like Princeton was a little bit all over the place defensively. So Penn State's second came off of a reset. Either the third or the fourth was a bad Finn Fox over the head check. The fifth came off of a bad clearing pass by Ryan Craddock, the goalie. And Luke Wallstrom scored twice on inverts. And then they gave up an own goal on man down. So when I look at that, with the exception of, all right, we got to be ready to go faster when a guy like Luke Wallstrom initiates, it's kind of like, all right, we clean up our clearing and, we have a freshman number one, projected number one defenseman. Don't go over the head up top. Like all of a sudden, we're not giving up seven. We're giving up three or four. That's a much more manageable situation. Equivalently, right, like Anderick Meekin supposed to be better than this from a face-off standpoint. Going against a Penn State unit that got a lot better at facing off as the year went on last year, but there are no great shakes. It's not going to be the best face-off unit that Princeton sees all season. So, I came away because I was – the reason that I was higher on Princeton than I was on Syracuse heading into this season was because I felt like replacing the combination of McAtee, where really thought like we would see a lot out of Bonanno, which we have not yet, and then the number one and two down low, which were Bath and Molshine, was going to be easier than Syracuse's task of replacing Hiltz, English, and Grace, because my thought there being, all right, we got you know, our midfield is back. We can rely on that. We feel like we've got, you know, a nice replacement at the attack. So it's really about rebuilding the defense, but at least we've got our goalie that we can build on. And maybe that'll end up being the case. And again, like, kind of in the same tone of the adage of don't react to Hlubahal and Villanova upsets, like maybe don't overreact to, you know, teams playing their first game looking bad against teams that are not playing their first game. That could very easily be a lesson that we try to file away coming away from this one. But at the same time, like, I'm with you, Larkin. It looked like there were some causes for concern that were a little deeper seated than I was afraid of.
Well, and Terry, I think you're being too nice. Sorry to talk over you, Larkin. I've been quiet for like 3 minutes, and that's my limit. What was most interesting to me is you can chalk up a lot of first game rust. You know, we're not flowing like we should. But, you know, from what I saw from Princeton's offense was the highest point of concern. And to me, you know, the two S's, speed and spacing. And it just seemed like Princeton – from an IQ standpoint, I don't know what they were doing in the preseason, and I'm not going to be overly critical because, again, you know, you're shaking the rust off. But there just seemed to be some basic things where it's like, hey, if you dodge, get out of your teammate's way. You know, there were certain patterns that I recognized throughout the game where I was like, this is not a high IQ offense, regardless of how rusty you are. There are certain principles that you can, you know, rely on from that speed and spacing, you know, getting a full head of steam, beating your guy, drawing the slide, moving it, beating your guy to space. It just kind of seemed like the problems that Princeton's offense were facing kind of stretched beyond Penn State's defense had a good game. Larkin, I don't know if you'd agree with that, but, you know, it was a bit of a head scratcher to me.
Yeah, I do agree. But When you're a team with championship aspirations, this is a shocking result, in my opinion, at home. And to answer your question, Terry, short 6D mid is where I think they need to get better in a hurry. Like, I don't love their athletes there, and I think...
You don't love Jackson Green?
No.
Interesting.
I don't love right.
I do.
Before, yes. Yeah. I also think that's the position that often, like, an IB team needs to get over the hump, is sure. Like the Ty Warner, Mark Lucini. Use the Yale analogy, but we can pause and move on.
I don't have anything more to say about this one. We're gonna learn about a lot about this team. I mean, Nick, like, your point is such salt in the wound for Princeton fans, because IQ is what this team is built off of offensively, right? Like, you know, Chad Palumbo is not, I mean, he's a midfielder of the year candidate. He's not an athlete, right? Like, he's not somebody that you would bet on being able to get back in the hole. You know, equivalently, Colin Burns is, you know, going to get short stick the majority of the time. If they are not out IQing their opponent, they're not going to put up 18 goals in a quarterfinal. And if that's what they're going to have to do, then... yeah, it's not a recipe for a successful season.
Well, and just to save myself from maybe looking stupid if Princeton's offense heats up, you know, I was a little too low on Penn State's defense. You know, losing to Villanova, not a good look. You know, some moments of, you know, confusion during that game for the Penn State defensive unit. And, you know, kind of I think Larkin mentioned it. I was expecting Princeton to come in and kind of have a statement here. And it certainly was a statement, but it left me. Yeah. Left me with some big questions on, you know, you don't want to be addressing the fundamentals of your offense heading into game two. That's something that you hash out in preseason with just some of the basic pillars of what we're trying to do offensively.
I think your point's exactly right in the sense that, to me, it's not about shaking off rust. It's about getting up to speed. Meaning, is the game fast enough? Are you thinking and playing fast enough for actual game speed as opposed to practice speed? And then the other point is, when it comes to defense, sometimes it's about making saves. And Penn State did not make saves in giving up 14 to Colgate and Villanova. And they made saves in Preston Hawkins getting to 60% against Princeton. Let's talk about another game where the goalie play may have been the difference. I don't think it was, but let's head down to Richmond.
Richmond, UVA. So this was a great test for UVA because Richmond is number two team in the country after this weekend, all in on the Spiders. A pretty interesting game. And my goodness, the star power was flying. 9-7 at half, but the Spiders were on a 7-0 run. Terry, you mentioned it. Connor Knight, Richmond goaltender with 18 saves, just an absolutely stellar performance. Aiden O'Neill had 5 goals. McCabe Millen crushed it kind of as advertised. I don't want to get too much into the game because what I really want to talk about is the Richmond Spiders mentality right now. We can talk about the game all we want. They are solidifying themselves and gaslighting themselves into thinking that they're a national championship contender, and I love it. I love it for them. In some of the post-game quotes, it was kind of that sense of last year was really cool, and we made the playoffs, and that was a really unique and fun experience for everybody. That, to me, is seeming like the standard, and the floor is now a good seed heading into the tournament, a decisive win, second win in a row over Virginia, 18-12 final. And are the Spiders a true Final Four contender? They certainly would say so, but what would you guys say?
Yeah, I think that it would be foolish not... Is Richmond a Final Four contender? I feel like that's one of the most important questions facing the season right now because it's going to be the lens through which the incredible non-conference schedule that they play gets evaluated, right? They're going to play Georgetown. Is Georgetown a Final Four contender? How do they play against Richmond? They're going to play Notre Dame. Is Notre Dame a Final Four contender? How do they play against Richmond? So I think we're going to continue to ask those questions through that lens and certainly Cornell as well, which is, again, a game that we're going to talk about. We're recording this on Monday night, and they played Mercer this afternoon, and that was a tight game through a good portion of the first half before Richmond separated in the start of the third quarter. And Mercer looks vastly improved over a 2-win team last year, but you know, how do you go from a convincing win against Virginia on Saturday to a relatively unconvincing win against Mercer 2 days later, unless you kind of get to some of the things that, you know, we just talked about? It's early in the season, two games in 3 days situation, getting a little high on the horse, all this stuff, man. It's so difficult because one of the things about sports is consistency. And one of the things about early season is that you haven't had the opportunity to display consistency, either being consistently good or consistently bad. Because if you've been good, you've only been good once or twice, maybe three times. And if you've been bad, same thing, right? So I'm trying not to ramble and dodge your question. So I'm just going to concede to Larkin. What do you think? Final Four contender?
Tentative yes, based on how open I think the fourth or the third or fourth seed could be for Memorial Day weekend. It'll come down to seeding. This could be a, you know, the entire, you know, Virginia Commonwealth could hate Donna or whoever the new lady is. If Richmond gets bagged with, you know, John Tillman and the quarters or whoever it is, right? But they have the constitution of a team and they're doing the right things, trying to improve their schedule. Like the big concern for the A-10, right, is Richmond's playing a bunch of quality early, and then they're going to beat the wheels off of like St. Bonaventure and St. Joe's and High Point in late April. And then do they get a really tough first round matchup with like Duke coming to town?
That's the somebody. Georgetown question, right? Georgetown has won the Big East 7 or 8 years in a row.
Like does the Delaware wound happen at Georgetown if Georgetown plays a slightly harder schedule that year late in April, right? I actually just think the far more interesting part of this game is Lars, I'm sure, was pounding his guys on we got to be better off the deck. They didn't GB well against Colgate. And at the dot, they were. They actually cleared okay. And, you know, there were not crazy fouls in this game. The real takeaway here is Virginia can't cover. And not only can they not cover, they're caught in between help and no help. So I think Virginia's offense has dramatically improved, at least just in terms of like, if you clip 60-second possessions, they look slightly more athletic. Like the first three possessions, I rewatched them, it looks like Hackett gets to his left, Holsey in the high, you know, the high center, wide open, bangs one. They look okay. Like Millen to his left beats Sunderland on a C cut. Like the O, you know, it looks improved. Let's call it improved. They played pretty bad defense in this game. So I, you know, it's all hands on deck trying to fix that. The great news for Virginia, of course, is that their schedule is the exact opposite. They have every opportunity in the world to get it going and try and pick people off down the stretch. So yeah, it's definitely shocking. Like, it's one of these where, like, Terry, you know, is the closest to this and has been setting this up, you know, all fall appropriately, but like, it is pretty wild to wake up and have like Richmond beating the wheels off of UBA at home on a Saturday in February. Like, it's, you know, not many people thought we'd be there a decade ago.
So to the earlier comment about trying to decide which end of the field is more responsible for the loss, you look at a final score and you're like 18-12. Obviously it's Virginia's defense. And that's the way that I gravitate as well. They gave up goals on 50% of Richmond's possessions. That's not good. That's not going to win you many ball games. But at the other end of the field, I agree, Larkin, the offense does look better. They scored 12 goals on 43 possessions. That's 27.9%. That's not going to win you many ball games either. So I guess my point is we shouldn't be too apologetic for the offense and blame everything on the defense. But again, we got to trust our eyes. And I think your point is well taken in the context. It's just like they're so caught in the middle. You know, in some instances, Dodgers get to 8 or 9 yards, no slide comes, bang an 8-yard, 9-yard shot on the run. In other instances, slide comes, no backside fill. I counted like 4 or 5 dunks on the doorstep in the first half. And, you know, that's one of the things that Richmond has been, you know, the best at with Lucas Littlejohn roaming the interior. And so I guess what my it felt like a football situation where an offensive coordinator totally had the opposing defensive coordinator on his heels, and the DC never knew whether they were going to run or pass, right? So they were just, you know, basically getting gashed for, you know, 8-yard run and then, you know, quick slant over the middle that went for 15. And it was just like no resistance all the way down the field. And, there was a lot of consternation around the Colgate result, and it was a win. And there were a lot of unique circumstances around it, right? And a win is a win in the early season. So should we overreact? All right, now you compound it with a loss to Richmond, and we start edging closer to what is the dramatic thing, the lever that we could pull here. And we've already seen it a little bit on the goalie side, which has not proven to be fruitful in terms of solutions for UVA over the course of the last several years. So I'm just kind of grasping at straws, and I wonder how much the staff is as well.
I mean, I can answer that. They're grasping. As far as just sitting in a dark room right now thinking about it. I think so. They have Stony Brook, who they should handle. I think if they're not dramatically playing better help front side D by Kopp, and they don't that look the part in that result irrelevant to win loss, I just want to put this out there. I've not talked to him about this, and frankly, he wouldn't tell me. I think we could see some serious junk coming from Charlottesville. And frankly, it'd be fun. It's been a long time since an ACC team like went to South Bend and tried to play like true junk food. So, you know, like invert zone where the poles are high and the shorties are low, like front side lock, and then you unlock once the dodge occurs to like then free help and then go out of like true junk, the type of shit you need to do. Sorry for swearing. If you coach at a lesser than program, which Lars did for a long time, trying to beat the Tom Schreibers and the Rob Pinnells and whoever, like, he did not cut his teeth with space eating athletes. He has things in his toolbox that he has not touched in 10 years.
Well, now that I am very curious to hear your perspective on that, because you know him better than I do. He has plenty of quality. He has a stable of horses. Do you think, I mean, it seems to me if he's going to start throwing junk ball, it's got to be at least halfway through the season when the wheels are fully off the wagon, not just a crack in the front two. Do you honestly believe we could see that in game 4?
Well, the only reason I was going to frame it that way was I think he believes, I think, the film on the O side better. So I don't think he wants to, like, punt the season and not at least try something dramatic. So, yeah, you could be right. It could be a high point or a Towson week. But, like, the first week in March, he has Towson, who I think we all agree is pretty good. And then
I don't want to cover Mikey Weishar.
Yeah, and then he has Tillman in College Park, right? Utah is solid, like, and then it's Notre Dame, Duke, Cuse, Owen Duffy. But, you know, maybe some of our listeners are younger. They don't remember the season where UVA under Dom played only zone late in the year and ended up winning. And to be clear, that was actually a fairly base zone. Lars has some crazy zone. Sideways zone, where poles are high, low. Like, so it, you know, I listen, maybe this is just me as a former junk defender trying to, like, speak it into existence. But I do think that it would be interesting to see. But let me put it this way. I am going to be fascinated to see the rate at which he decides to, A, change personnel or to change scheme. I'll stop it there.
Let's go to Ithaca. Actually, no, this game took place in Albany.
Let's go to Albany. Cornell, rewind the clocks just a little bit. If you're a fan of lacrosse, you probably know they won the national championship. Their first game in the playoffs en route to said national championship was against the Albany Great Danes. Kind of beat the brakes off of them, but Albany almost upset the Big Red. Final score was 11-10, and this was one of those interesting games where it seemed like there were four or five games within the games, four or five different types. It kind of became a slugfest. There was goals back-to-back, then there were goal droughts. It just kind of seemed that the game never truly took shape and maintained that shape for more than a couple minutes at a time. Ultimately, Goldstein with a – was it Goldstein or Firth? Gosh, I don't have this in my notes. Scored the final goal.
Firth.
Terry, was it Goldstein or Firth? It was Firth. I knew it was Firth. Because Goldstein doesn't do toe drags. Bad. -5 for me. Firth, nasty toe drag late in the game to ultimately have the win. But I got to say, if – you know, we've kind of been saying this for years. UAlbany is a fun and frisky team. Doherty and Palum, each with four goals apiece. They're returning most of their offensive production, which is a fun, high caliber. You know, you talk about junk ball. I don't want to call it junk ball, but there's not a way in which they consistently score back-to-back goals. It seems like everything, you know, every possession is a brand new opportunity to do some wild stuff for Albany's offense. And Cornell, you know, the low-hanging fruit that I will pick right here, how are you going to respond to CJ Kirst's departure? It kind of seemed like they didn't exactly know. They got enough to get it done, but some big questions for the Big Red.
I feel as if Terry and I did a decent job setting the table last week, so hopefully people listen then and the follow-up now. But let me start with bullet A. I think Cornell's still pretty good. I think the one of the unfortunate realities when you watch a team late into May and you build the narrative around a Goldstein and around a Firth and around a Staub is the truth behind this is Jeff Teat and CJ Kirst are two of the best left-handers to, like, ever play the sport. Okay? Like, they draw so much attention, and they have been on the last 8 teams, let's call it, for Cornell, have had the privilege of having one of those two players. Okay? So this group is going to look different, and they're going to have to win games in different ways, and they're going to have to engineer stops, and there are going to be weeks. And I actually would not put Albany in this bucket, so that's actually probably the biggest red flag. But there will be weeks where there are two poles on an opponent who can take away a Goldstein and a Firth. So you're going to have to win games with guys who most of the country's never heard of because the Kelleher's of the world are gone, right? So I think this is the moment at which everyone will take a deep breath and say Cornell's come back to earth. They are still, you know, probably favored in our league. Them and Princeton are right there. In no way is they obviously got the job done. They won the game. But it's just like a reminder of, when you're looking for, like, leading indicators heading into a year, anytime, like, a generational talent departs a program, irrelevant to the quality of the overall group, if you just focus on that side of the ball, like, that side of the ball is going to be worse. Like, Cornell's offense is not going to sing and have the synergy and the east-west momentum the way they did last year, where it literally looked like music. Like, it was beautiful. And, you know, the one thing I'll say is we're going to learn a lot more about Connor Busick this year, too. Right, in the sense of you know, late game management. I mean, he's going to have to, you know, coach in different ways and find ways to generate leverage with you know, young middies and whatever. It's just a lot different than when 15 can pick up the rock and like go hard at his pole. So yeah, credit to him for getting it done, but we'll see.
Larkin, you said you were shocked by the Penn State Princeton result. I was shocked by this one. And yeah, for a variety of reasons, one of which being that I wasn't as high on Albany as others on the basis of what they were bringing back. Really, you know, kind of informed by some of their scrimmage results. And so the thing that I saw when watching this game was two relatively even teams. I didn't think there was very much on film that suggested that there was a ton of distance between these two squads. Larkin, or I'm sorry, Nick, I like the way that you framed, like, the game kind of flowed in sections or chunks, right? So, like, Albany early was getting on the board, finding success, really picking on Cornell's shorties. Their first goal was basically a shorty getting lost off ball. Then their second and third goals were both just dusting guys. You know, at the other end of the field, it was the Ryan Goldstein show early. First of all, shout out Black or Black Shoes. Like, nobody wears black shoes anymore, but fully respect that move, especially on somebody who weighs like 130 pounds. But, you know, he scored the first goal off of quickness. Then he had a hilarious bottom-up skip pass to Bowie Horseman for a step down that was probably like a 35-yard pass that he actually had to jump in order to get like the angle and leverage on. And then I used the comment earlier about the repeatability, sustainability, concern level of certain types of goals. You know, Cornell gave up a couple goals that, like, you're just like, all right, we'll keep it moving, right? Matt Tully gets stripped as soon as he crosses the midline on a clear, and then they score like a 40-yard open netter, and then Jackson Palem scores this ridiculous BTB with a guy draped all over him. It's just like, what are you going to do about that? And then Firth took over, right, in the middle of the second quarter, and then obviously, Nick, you said, you know, had the game-winning goal with 37 seconds left. One of the reasons that I was shocked by this is that if you had told me that Silas Richmond was going to get limited to two assists on five shots and that Albany was going to be able to play Cornell to a one-goal game, I would have been pretty stunned by that. I think it's interesting to continue to watch. You know, we've talked a fair amount about zone on this in this conversation already. Albany used a decent amount of zone in this. And then just the last thing that I would say, and, you know, it's kind of a lesson to be learned. It's a tough way to lose a game, but, you know, Albany lost this on a failed clear, right? And it's another kind of element of early season lacrosse and element of the games that we've talked about already this weekend. You know, it's one thing to have the ball get ridden back based on effort, and it's another thing to give the ball back based on either, you know, kind of sloppy stick handling or just, you know, not being in the right position, trying to run through a double that you didn't need to, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot to be taken away from this game. I think the biggest thing is I know that there's not a lot of cheap Albany stock lying around because they are America's team in many respects. But anything that I find that feels underpriced, I'm going to buy.
I will say, as far when we talk about sustainability, it seems like, especially last year, and it's looking like this year, Albany finds a way to sustain themselves on unsustainable goals.
Correct.
And that's why I really enjoy watching them. They manufacture the most brilliant goals and the dumbest goals all wrapped up into one beautiful, you know, seemingly train wreck. And, you know, I thought it was an interesting contrast. Again, we talk about, you know, obviously CJ Kearse isn't going to be there. And to me, it almost seemed like a lot of the players, and I'm going to probably butcher what I'm trying to say here, but it seemed like a lot of the rest of the offense was trying to figure out ways to fill that gap because they didn't have a lot of initiating opportunities last year. Whereas on the Albany side, could be something said for, hey, if we're going to, you know, throw junk goals and just kind of do whatever it is we have the capability to do, it seemed like even though they came away with a loss, Albany's offense can play whatever game is in front of them, and Cornell has a little bit more of an uphill battle figuring out how they're going to consistently get goals on the board because they rely more on structure and sustainability than Albany. It was a fun matchup, got to say.
All right, let's give the people what they want. Let's go to Alumni Corner. We're going to start in Fairfield, Connecticut. A home road game for our friend Mr. Kemp. Brown is 1-0. Larkin, what'd you see?
Very rare to dominate start to finish. And by dominate, I mean like 8-15. We beat the home team's captain's parents to the cement, like effectively trying to just take over and establish our trailer, which has been custom made around state, fully portable bar and televisions, like can plug in anywhere on the planet. It's actually really cool. I do love it. But it, listen, I'm very happy for the guys. Like Fairfield is a, is not a team you want in week one when they've played the weekend prior. Like they're actually pretty solid. They do unique things. They 10 man, for those who maybe just enjoy old school takeaways, number 27, the close defenseman for Fairfield. He's like one of the best takeaway guys I've seen with quite slow feet, maybe ever. And what I mean by that is not like a dominant athlete, but he gets like 4 cost turnovers a game, which is very hard to do in this era of stick protection when like the ex-attackmen have like grocery bags with whip. So he deserves a ton of credit for that. And yeah, it was just like, it was full grit both directions, turnovers both sides of the ball, like ton of sloppiness. But the truth of when you are bad for a few years, you typically get pretty darn good at grinding out stops. Like the Brown D the last 2 years has not been like pathetic on in terms of like data analytics. Like Connor Fole is good. Cave is good. Trey Taylor's solid. Samari Staton could play in the PLL. He's a really good SSDM. And we got this Bamper out of California that frankly I've never heard of, but he may be my new best friend because he actually might be good at Osawa. We were just making, taking, and we have a 50-53, the lefty freshman Canadian. I know nothing about him other than the fact that I may love him. Like he needs to start and he needs to build his confidence, and hopefully he can become like our version of, you know, 6 goals a game. You know, we just feed the guy in the half wall. We'll take James Steele. Remember the net.
It's a great name. It is a great name. Nick, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. What happened?
What happened was the broadcasters didn't do their prep. But this Josh Yago guy, he's going to be a pretty good, impactful player for Notre Dame. You know, I hate to be critical first of the alma mater, but that's just how I am. You know, I don't have delusions of grandeur for what my team is, as opposed to other people on this podcast. But what I will say is the concerns were outweighed by the talent that I saw on the field. You talk about a team that was scoring unsustainable goals. Marquette had some ridiculous, oh, you're catching, you're falling down, you're throwing a backhand goal that goes bar down. Game was closer than I would have liked. And the concern for me has been the concern since 2024, you know, kind of through last season and to the start of this one. The offense just sometimes forgets how to play offense for 5 minutes at a time. And there are two or three possessions in a row where it seems like the personnel that is on the field is not comfortable with the sets that they're running. And what I mean by that is it's kind of like the high wing dodge, kind of two-man exchange, a semi version of what Duke was running in you know, the late 20-teens. And the frustrating part is that works for when the Kavanaughs are there, when the Jake Taylors are there, when you have Dobson up top. I don't think there's the peaks and the valleys of player personnel where it's, you know, hey, this guy is the clear initiator. I think Wilma Harris's first step is the X factor for this offense. Josh Yago's size, IQ, and passing talent. But is the offense set to consistently take advantage of those skill sets? Or is it trying to fit a square peg into a round hole and say, hey, we're going to do kind of these, maybe it's a pick, maybe it's not, semi-Canadian box approach, but the looks weren't there. And what I mean by the looks was that the vision wasn't there. It seemed like the ball wasn't out of the stick by the time it should have, or it was arriving to the hands late. So with that being my takeaway, I think Wilma Harris and Josh Yago have the capability to completely take over games. You know, the defense was the defense. Sean Light, absolutely insane. Reasonably impressed with the goaltender. I would say 7 out of 10 for a win against Marquette. A win's a win in February. And welcome back, college lacrosse. I mean, I didn't miss anything because the season starts when Notre Dame plays.
That'll do it for Alumni Corner. We're going to close it because I think we're going to spend a little bit more time on Notre Dame-Georgetown next week. We've got a handful of other results that we got to hit on. First and foremost, congratulations to Siena coach Tim Cox. We've obviously spent a lot of time over the course of the last 2.5 months talking about Liam Gleason's untimely death and incredible generosity of spirit, donating organs that saved the lives of 4 people that Siena Saints continue to march on and got their first win at home in conjunction with an IMLCA Coaches Association effort to provide pins for college lacrosse coaches to wear that said LG on them. So that was a great gesture. Rory Connor, 7 goals. Liam Connor, 5 assists in Georgetown's debut, a win over Penn. Johns Hopkins, dominant first midfield performance. Loyola clears a paltry 66% as the Blue Jays win the Battle of Charles Street 13-7. Lehigh upsets Michigan. And then Grayson Manning makes 19 saves in Denver's win over Utah. You guys got anything on any of those results?
One of the best stories going in sports right now is Tim Cox. And It's one of my favorite articles that's been written on Inside Lacrosse and what that first victory meant to him. And who better to fill Gleason's shoes than somebody who immediately takes the attention off of himself and talks about the resiliency of the athletes on the field and what they've gone through. You know, I can only imagine what Tim and, you know, certainly the Gleason family and that entire program has gone through. I think the mark of a great coach is to be in that position and immediately when asked about what he personally has been going through to deflect right to how strong the players are. If you're listening and you haven't read that article, go to Inside Lacrosse right now and pick it up. It was fantastic. And, you know, the other takeaway from this slew of headlines, minor setback for a major comeback, I think, for Michigan. I don't expect them to go down 5-0 and just spot a team 5 goals. Their offense is too good. Their goaltending is too good. And don't be surprised if Michigan makes a little bit of noise this year and this is the motivation they needed.
Larkin, any thoughts?
I don't hate that take. The only challenge for Michigan, unfortunately, is that if Lehigh fades, no different than for Penn State, if Villanova fades, this is one that can have serious implications come Selection Sunday. I watched all of Michigan Marquette. I think Michigan's pretty good. So I was just actually fairly surprised by the result. So credit to the Lehigh coaching staff for heading into Ann Arbor and getting that done. The only other one I thought noteworthy from our notes, Hofstra's struggling to open. And I know Seth, you know, the whole coaching community respects Seth and whatever, but it, I guess just as a flag, if Hofstra were ever to open or if they moved on at some point, probably amicably, I guess he could probably do whatever he wants. But that's just always I've thought of as like a sleeping giant because of location, in the sense of if they were ever resourced properly. Like I don't know anything about their budget, but them and Stony Brook, I've always in my head thought if the right pieces came together, it's certainly an interesting job. And then the last one, a really big win for Denver, Matty Brown, in my opinion. Like I think he's still trying to find his footing in kind of the post-Tierney era, but I think they're going to be pretty good. And I think depending on, you know, where Georgetown is, like maybe we have, you know, a potential multi-headed Big East versus just one. So that was a big result as well. And the last is down my throat, Nick's guy, Jerry Byrne, Harvard's D looked better. They did. They really did. So that's one to monitor if Harvard can fly in recovery.
Doubling back on Denver, we're going to get a really solid look at the Pioneers as the Cornell Big Red head to town on Saturday. That's going to be one of the marquee games to watch. Fellas, as always, go ahead, Nick.
I would just like to wrap up by saying, I'm sorry, life is, pardon my French, complete shit show right now. It's what, February 16th? I've been on 26 flights this year.
Oh my God.
Closing on a house, planning a wedding. I will do my best to be better prepared, more attentive, and, you know, getting the people that this sport actually relies on to come back to the Tailgate Podcast instead of having to suffer through a Terry Larkin solo episode. So I apologize. That's on me.
Fantastic notes to end on. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and a review. Tell a friend, and we'll be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse Podcast. Love you, boys.
Love you, Terry. Love you, Larkin.
Yeah,
love you, Larkin.